For the week of October 13th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 465, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gilt. It's going to be a great episode this week. It better be, because there won't be an episode next week. Thank you, Sperling.
Yes, it's my fault.
It is your fault. You're traveling.
I'm speaking at the Middle East North Africa Conference, or Cinema Forum, I should say. Middle East North Africa Cinema Forum, otherwise known as the MENA Cinema Forum, in Dubai next week. Say hello.
What are you speaking on?
It's a panel on technology in cinema, which we're going to be talking about a little bit today.
That's right. We certainly are. So are there any other trips coming up? I mean, you've got Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year. You know, is there anything else you want to tell us right now about how many episodes we can expect through the rest of the year?
No, unless there's something you need to tell me.
Nope.
I don't know what the rest of the year holds for me. Sorry.
Letting people down left and right. I mean, if you're traveling so much, shouldn't you be more successful?
Pretty much, yeah. You're not the first person to say that.
All right. Well, we're not going to have a show next week, but we will have one this week. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we will deliver this podcast at our highest frame rate ever.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Was that really fast?
Oh my God, that was really fast. Yeah. Yes. And it's so clear, crystal clear.
Crystal.
Okay. That's really not true because this is an audio podcast, not a video podcast. But we will tackle the promise and peril of high frame rate, HFR. Jeff Boucher of Deadline spoke with director Ang Lee about that very issue. And Jeff is here to discuss Gemini Man, not to mention the phenomenon that is Joker and all things pop culture. On Inside Baseball, we'll head to China because the government cannot stop making headlines. It scrubbed South Park from that country's internet after a new episode mocked its human rights record. Then it urged a video game company to stifle free speech and won. And then it got in a battle with basketball. So for anyone complaining that sports shouldn't really have involve politics, tell that to China, okay? We'll discuss what this means for all the businesses that want a piece of the Chinese market but don't want to damage their brand worldwide. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right. We look at box office around the world and we count up the total box office for the last 7 days. Most people are starting to look at worldwide box office, but they're still focusing just on the last 3 or 4 days. If a movie opens up this week, they'll usually count the box office from Thursday through Sunday. But if it's already been open up for a week or two, then they only count the box office from Friday to Sunday. It's crazy. It's absurd. And there's no better example of that than this week's number one movie. The number one movie around the world this week is Joker. It grossed $296 million worldwide last week. It's at $550 million practically and counting. It's a huge, huge hit. And here's how much money it made. Monday through Thursday in North America, it made like $42 million. Worldwide, just on the weekdays alone, Joker made $119 million last week from Monday through Thursday. That means it was the number one movie in the world, even if you only counted its Monday through Thursday box office and gave everybody else the entire week's box office. Not just the weekend, not just 4 days, but all 7 days. That's how important those 4 days are. And this is October. This isn't the middle of summer or a holiday. It wasn't Thanksgiving or Christmas to New Year's. It wasn't a big holiday in China. It was just a regular old October week when kids are back at school. And yet Joker made $119 million worldwide on the weekdays alone. That's why we talk about the worldwide box office. That's why we look at the entire 7 days of box office, because a lot of money is being made Monday through Thursday.
I have to say, you know, there's something called word of mouth, and I'm kind of being glib, but and when it comes to word of mouth, you want positive word of mouth, generally, but I have had more people tell me not to see this movie. Well, than any movie in recent history.
Well, that's not the word of mouth that you can see at the box office, however, because it's done really well weekdays. I thought it would have a much stronger fall off the second weekend. I thought fanboys who went and said, it's not really a superhero movie. It didn't really have that poppy fun, but nihilism is selling. And the word of mouth in general is good because Joker is, you know, being seen. Maybe it's the sort of movie that people feel they have to see or want to see. But when you're looking at numbers like this, you're also talking about repeat business.
Yes, you know, correct.
This movie is making a lot of money worldwide. This is not a movie we looked at and said, wow, here's a potential billion-dollar movie. But my gosh, it's barreling on its way towards that. It's over half a billion already. It made more money its second week than its first week. It made $300 million this week. That's a lot of money. And it was the number one movie in the world, even if you just count Monday through Thursday. I think that's hugely impressive. At number two around the world is The Captain. This is the Chinese spin on Sully. It's a true story about a Chinese pilot where the windshield or the front of the plane blows off and they have to make an emergency landing. It made $93 million last week. So all 7 days, it made $93 million. It's at $340 million worldwide and counting. Right below that is another big Chinese film. It's My People, My Country. That's the anthology, including one directed by... Sperling, I don't know how to say his name. Say his name for me.
Oh, Shen Kaigu?
Yeah, thank you very much. Shen Kaigu. It grossed $75 million last week. It's at $360 million worldwide. And then jumping down a little bit, there is The Climbers at number six, another big Chinese film. This co-stars Jackie Chan. It also stars the guy who was in Wolf Warrior 2, who's a big star. It made $32 million last week. It's at $138 million worldwide and counting.
If when those people were climbing, they passed Abominable.
They might have. But looking at those three films, those are three big Chinese films. The Captain opened lower a little bit than My People, My Country. Now it's passing it up. It looks like it's going to end up being the bigger hit. That one is still gaining ground and doing really well. My People, My Country is still bigger overall, but The Captain is, I think, going to lap it. So those three movies have been doing so well in China that the box office for the entire country has done a big turnaround. As of September 30th, the Chinese box office was down about 3% from last year. Now in 2 weeks, it's now 4% over last year. So it made a 7% jump in just 14 days. That's what a lot of big hits will do you. Three movies, they've grossed $830 million worldwide, most of it in China. So the Chinese box office is now at $7.52 billion for the year. It's up over last year. And so that string of continuing growth 1 year over the next looks like it's going to continue for China. At least they've turned it around and they've got a shot at it. Back at the worldwide box office, at number four after Joker, The Captain, and My People, My Country is Gemini Man, the new film directed by Ang Lee and starring Will Smith. It grossed $60 million worldwide on its opening week. We'll certainly be talking to Jeff about that film. He had a nice feature talking with Ang Lee about, he feels a little beleaguered, you know, tackling all this technology and feeling like people are just sort of saying, nah, don't do that, rather than trying to appreciate what they're trying to do artistically.
Well, I mean, we can talk about that with Jeff, but yeah, I have my thoughts on that.
Well, good. At number five.
And I think it stars Will Smith and the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, doesn't it?
That's right. At number five is Abominable, that co-production between Universal and a Chinese company. I forget which one. But that was hoping to have a big mark in China. There's links there in the storyline. It was made with a company there. It's not really tearing it up in China. It was not a winner at the box office, completely overshadowed by the big local hits. But Abominable made $32 million last week. It's at $108 million worldwide. Then comes The Climbers, starring Jackie Chan, and then another new film. This is the animated flick The Addams Family, the upteenth reboot of that franchise, which started as comics, you know, not a comic strip, but comic panels in The New Yorker. That is at $30 million worldwide. That's what it's made on its opening weekend. And they say the budget for the film is $40 million? Really?
That's super low. Yeah, it is super low, and it was done on a shoestring.
Wow, that's really cheap for an animated film. Oh, and by the way, Gemini Man, they say that one cost $140 million. I mean, I guess Will Smith is the only one getting a paycheck there, but given the envelope-pushing technology, that sounds a little low to me, too. At number 8 is War, the Indian action film that made $28 million this week. It's at $52 million and counting. Right below that is Downton Abbey, another $17 million worldwide. That's now at $150 million and counting. Then another hit. This is a Hong Kong thriller. It's called A Witness Out of the Blue. It only opened up on Saturday. I've noticed this the last couple of weeks. We've had movies that open up on Saturday. It's, you know, we had those movies that opened up on National Day, which was a Monday, like The Captain and My People, My Country and The Climbers. And in the last few weeks in China and India, there are some movies that open up on Saturday. I'm not quite sure why or how that happens. Maybe it has something to do with religious traditions or holidays. I don't know.
Well, think about it this way. In the Middle East, the week starts on Sunday.
Okay. So, how does that mean you'd rather open up on a Saturday than Friday night?
Friday is the, holy day, so you open up on Saturday.
Okay, but it doesn't seem to be a given. A lot of movies don't open up on Saturday. It seems to be...
Correct.
Right, so I'm wondering why these particular films, in this case, are opening up on a Saturday. A Witness of Out of the Blue opened up on Saturday. It grossed $15 million. Sometimes they really slip through the cracks because Comscore doesn't get those figures, and other people... have to step into the breach. I think I caught this on Variety or Hollywood Reporter on a roundup of foreign box office. If you know why some movies might open up on a Saturday or why they all don't open up on Saturday, if there's a religious reason for that, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also... follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/Showbiz Sandbox is where you can find our page. And all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
That's right. So we're out of the top 10 now. Jennifer Lopez, the Super Bowl halftime star of the future, her movie Hustlers hit $120 million worldwide. I was wrong about Joker, which I kind of expected to have a bit of a harder drop on its second week because I thought word of mouth would not be that good, but apparently it's more controversial and, you got to see it, rather than stay away, because that movie did great. The same is true for Judy, starring Renee Zellweger. I thought this movie would not hold up, but people are responding and liking it. It made $11 million worldwide last week. It's at $21 million and counting. This is a small art house pick. It's going to be an Oscar hopeful. Certainly it's going to get a nomination for Renee Zellweger. So this movie is doing gangbusters. Right below that is Ad Astra, which is at $120 million. And It, Chapter 2, that made $9 million, just like Ad Astra. It's at $445 million worldwide. It seems to have really slowed down. I'm not sure if there are any big territories left. And it's well off the $700 million of It, Chapter 1. People are not responding to this as much. But it only costs $90 million to make. So those two movies together, you're looking at $1.2 billion. So everybody's happy. Rambo, Last Blood, that's not doing well. That's at $82 million worldwide. The Angry Birds movie 2 is a bit of a flop. Then there's the Korean rom-com, The Most Ordinary Romance. That made another $5 million, so that had a good hold this week. That's at $11 million worldwide. And towards the bottom are two new movies. One is Jexy, if I'm saying that right. It's sort of a spoof on Siri and voice assistants that you have on your phone or your home, speaker system. That stars Adam Devine, and it made a pretty modest $3 million. But right below that is a Met Opera production, Turandot or Turandot. I don't know how to say that.
Turnado?
No. It's T-U-R-A-N. So how could it be Turnado?
I've always heard it pronounced
Turandot. It must
Turandot.
Be Turandot.
Yeah.
You said Turnado. Turandot. Okay. The Met Opera, simulcast around the world, that made a strong $3 million. I had a friend who saw it and said it was very lavish indeed.
Now I want to see it.
Yeah. No, I would like to see it. And opening up in limited release here in North America is Parasite, the Palme d'Or winner, making a lot of money in its home country. It opened up on 3 screens and it almost made it into the top 10. It made $125,000 per screen. That is the largest per screen average ever for a foreign language film in North America. So we've got a Spanish film, a Korean film, and a documentary in the top 20. That's always good to see. And Parasite is getting off to a tremendous start.
Have you seen this film?
I have not.
Okay, it's worth seeing.
No, I have seen it. What am I talking about? I did see Parasite. I liked it and I did not love it. I'm happy to see it again, just like Pain and Glory. I respected it. I was not happy with the direction it went in. There was nothing wrong with the choice. I just didn't find it satisfying. And it ended well at the very end. I liked the little twist at the end, a little way they presented the last little idea of the movie. It's well acted, well made. It's certainly a worthwhile film to see, but right now it's not on my best of the year list. But I would give it 3 stars out of 4. I do want to see it again. You know, sometimes it's hard to hear it's the best movie of the year. You know?
And then go see it, and you're like, oh.
Right, but well. I really did have serious problems with some of the directions it took. I do want to see it again, and I certainly recommend it. It's certainly a worthwhile movie, and if you want to be part of the conversation, you're going to have to watch it.
Well, and I say that that movie, which premiered on the same day in Cannes as Quentin Tarantino's last movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Well, that was a good day.
Yes, correct. And I think the people kind of went into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and which is a good movie, not a Quentin Tarantino great movie. And then 2 hours later went to see Parasite and were just blown away because it was the narrative-driven movie that I guess they were hoping Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I mean, Once Upon a Time got good buzz out of Cannes. It wasn't like people said it wasn't good. It's your own personal reaction you're dealing with.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. That was a good day. Two of the big movies of the year, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is in fact on our chart, which you can find in our show notes. It's at number 21 worldwide. It made $3 million last week. It's at $366 million worldwide. Be interesting to see if they just push it onto streaming or DVD and Blu-ray, or whether they, you know, give another theatrical push after the Oscar nominations come out.
Yeah, I mean, you saw the film, correct?
Yes, I did. I was not thrilled with that.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah. That wouldn't be on my best of the year list for that either. I'm sorry. I wish it were.
Yeah, all right. I'm not complaining. I like you, I thought, it's good. It's good. The guy knows how to write a movie. It's well above average. Well, since we're talking about box office and you know, the first two films we talked about really were what? Joker and Gemini Man. Well, those were the two big films we were talking about. Why don't we welcome Jeff Boucher, the genre editor at Deadline, and the Nick Fury of its Hero Nation silo, a great source for the latest news about comic books and pop culture. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Hey, guys.
You did a major sit-down, I love that word, major sit-down, with director Ang Lee to talk about his new film, Gemini Man, at the time. He was already smarting from reviews of the film. Now, how is he going to feel after Gemini Man's opening weekend?
Not good. He's not going to feel good at all. I mean, yeah, he was really down in the mouth when I saw him. And of course, you know, they get projections and they have,
they know how it's tracking.
Yeah, they know how it's tracking with their marketplace stuff. So I'm sure the handwriting was on the digital wall. But yeah, it's interesting. He's a very nice guy. And he's a very talented filmmaker. And I really feel for him. You know, I really like him. He wears his heart on his sleeve. So it was pretty obvious that he's feeling not just a little defeated maybe, but also I think misunderstood in some ways.
He seems really beleaguered. Like, why are people not supporting this attempt to do something new and different and bold? Why are they acting like I'm insulting them?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think you're exactly right that he does seem to feel that way. And I kind of wanted to tell him, like, you know, we all like kids' science projects, but we don't want to pay $22 for them on a Friday night. you know, I think that people want to, at the end of the credits, want to be entertained by a movie, not support a scientific push into cinematic arts.
And what we're talking about here is the fact that Gemini Man employs a 120 per frame high frame rate, that it's using 3D, and it also is working with de-aging computer programs to have Will Smith act alongside a younger version of himself. These are all sort of groundbreaking, pushing the envelope attempts to up the game on what technology can do in a movie. And that's cool philosophically, but you know, in the early days of sound, even when it was rough, people loved it. They were just excited to be able to hear sound. In the early days of color, people loved it. They were really excited by it. The early days of high frame rate, people are not excited.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, Michael, I would say that it's almost comparable in a different way to the advent of radio when, you know, like the, if you look at the career of Bing Crosby, mm-hmm. one of the things that he did, he was one of those artists that came along at a time when there was innovation, and he either intuitively or consciously kind of fell in step with that. You know, the singing tradition before Bing Crosby was defined largely by people like Al Jolson.
Baby, I love you, baby. Exactly. Louder and louder, so you could be heard through the Victrola
and through the venues. You know, where they weren't going to be electronically amplified, in necessarily or not in ways that mattered. So it was to sing to the back row, and Bing was the first hugely successful artist who made people lean forward at the radio instead of lean backwards, because you know he with the sort of the crooning and the burbling tune. He was able to bring a sort of intimacy and a different way of doing the art.
That's right. Bing Crosby turned the microphone into an instrument, and he knew that the microphone was a new way of allowed you to be that intimate and revealing and personal, but it was immediately successful and it immediately worked. There was no need for people to sort of learn what's going on here. It was immediately grabbed you in and was exciting. People were, you know, he was a huge star from the get-go when he hit the game because he knew how to use the microphone, and there were great singers before him, but they were not playing with the microphone the way he did. That was his big innovation, but it was immediately successful, yeah. Unlike high frame rate and to a degree 3D.
Right. Well, they clearly need their Bing Crosby, and that's what Ang Lee is saying, is that the technology with the high frame rate is such a difference maker, and it changes so much the planes of vision and the planes of perception that it needs a fundamentally different way of being made, and that all the movies that we've seen so far doing it, including his, have been made under the traditions and assumptions and conventions of traditional. Mm. And it's so different that, you know, he doesn't say this, but essentially that they need their Bing and they haven't got their Bing yet.
Well, one more thing, Sperling, before you jump in, sorry to cut you off, but you know, we can make movies that are presented in wraparound screens. I've gone to Disney World and seen, you know, nature docs where you're going through the Grand Canyon and the screen encircles the audience. We have virtual reality. We have 3D. We have high frame rate. Every toy that is available isn't necessarily the wave of the future for cinema. It might be useful in some different way, but VR is not the future of cinema necessarily as such. So yes, the tech is there, but does it need to be part of the conversation all the way that sound and color and other options are for theatrical movies? I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's a very good point. And same with 3D, you know, and that one's been hurt because of the nature of Hollywood's exploitation of it. You know, I mean, you know, James Cameron spent a decade trying to put Avatar together and the 3D and the CGI, the CG effects to create the facial capture to take the acting to a new level. But then, you know, The Clash of the Titans came out and they spent about 22 minutes on their 3D and charged money for it. And that sort of became the North Star for Hollywood, because no one wanted to spend a decade. So everybody kind of took the other route and it was a race to the bottom with 3D. And then I think that, you know, Aang's frustration is that he doesn't think 3D ever got a chance. I mean, we've had it for a decade, but
no, we've had it for 60, 70 years.
Of course. But I mean, as far as being a part of the contemporary price scale at theaters, I mean, you know, after Avatar, it became much more common and much more pervasive. And we saw competing versions of it and things like that. And you know, just in Aang's view, that the past decade since Avatar, its 10th anniversary is this December, I think, that in that time we actually lost ground because the 3D exploitation took it further away from the principles of exploration. I mean, he's approaching it, you know, almost scientifically, even though he's not necessarily a tech guy. He's more of a lyrical kind of poet, guy, visual poet. But
But he seems completely lost in the technology. This is a guy who's made some of my favorite films of all time, personally, like Sense and Sensibility, The Ice Storm, Eatrick Man Woman, Crouching Tiger, to a degree, Brokeback Mountain. These are films with great screenplays. And the screenplay seems to be the last thing on his mind for his last five movies, from Lost Caution to Taking Woodstock to Billy Lynn's longtime, half-longtime walk or whatever. And now this movie, the screenplay seems an afterthought to all the tricks he's playing with technology. He seems to have completely lost the fact that none of it matters if you don't have a good story.
I could not agree with you more. It seems to me like he's put, the spectacle out front. And I mean, I asked him about this, why he picked this movie, why he picked this script. And essentially he gave me a checklist. Well, I need a movie that did this, 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 and this, it's kind of like, when you would buy a Viewmaster cartridge in the 70s and you would always buy the Grand Canyon, not, the desert, because it looks better, in 3D. I mean, he's picking things based on how they look in the Viewmaster.
Well, certainly speaking of the Viewmaster here, he shot this film, Ang Lee that is, at 120 frames per second. And that's what we're talking about, HFR, high frame rate. It is not being projected at 120 frames per second. It is being projected at 60 frames per second per eye. So that's, again, if you have 3D,
that's faster than normal, though, right?
It's faster. It's 24 frames per second is normal. And there are times where it does look awkward. It does not look, it removes you from the film. Now, if the story were better, maybe it would not have, but it definitely, the technology is there. It just needs to be applied properly.
Or does it? As Michael says, it's one of those things. It's like, just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean you should or have to. But and I think there was only one time when I was talking to Aang where he got a little upset, I think, with me, because I said, I think if you had picked a different movie, people might not be so harsh on it. But this movie is so fairly simple or rudimentary in its plot. I mean, it's like the most basic of action movies, really. And it's with an extremely familiar star. We're used to looking at him, and it's a movie with a lot of real world detail filling the screen. I said that if with Life of Pi or with Avatar, we're looking at things we're not used to seeing, and our scrutiny isn't as harsh probably. But if you show people Will Smith on a motorcycle, we know what Will Smith looks like. We know what motorcycles look like. And I think it created an even more severe standard of expectation.
Well, here's what I think is interesting. I feel like you're like the soft shoulder for them to lean on. You deal with a lot of people a lot of time who, whether their movies are successful commercially or not successful, like perhaps in the case of Gemini Man, they're making stuff that doesn't get a lot of respect. They make movies, people may yell and scream about Avengers, but that's not getting on a lot of best of the year lists. And these people love movies and they want their movies to be respected. They love great movies. And you again and again deal in a world where people are both hugely successful a lot of the times, but also do not get that critical support. And so it's interesting for you to come in there and be there with them and sort of respect the work that they're doing, respect the property, and know what they're doing both with comic books and with movies. And I wonder about that relationship that you have with Ang Lee and all the Marvel people and all that world, because you're sort of a unique space for them, it seems like.
I hadn't really thought of it that way specifically, but as you say that, I realize that that's probably the signature of my career at this point. Is I take the confessions of popcorn sinners. But you're right. I can give you an example too, like Michael Bay. After I left Entertainment Weekly, there was a time I was kind of just freelancing, and I got a call from Michael Bay asking me to come to Chicago to visit the set of his new Transformers movie, just because he wanted to know if I thought it would be a good movie, like if what my opinion of what he was doing was. And I'm like,
wow,
Michael, I don't understand. You want me to fly to Chicago and just kind of hang out for a day or two? He's like, yeah, you did set visits on all my other movies. I'd like you to. every Transformers movie before this. I'd like you to do one on this. And I said, but I'm not really writing for anybody right now. And he didn't care. And he basically wanted me to tell him that, you know, it was okay, that it was respectable. And because I hadn't done that on the previous movies. I would visit these movies and he would ask me what I think. And I would say, these movies are very successful. You know, I would say, you know, I see what your ambitions are. I would say all these things that were, you know, clinically
polite,
but you know, he's a bright enough guy, that he wanted more. So I flew out to Chicago and was there for a couple of days and I said, I see what you're aiming for. I understand what you're doing.
And the question is, will it be successful? We'll find out.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and he more than anybody, I mean, he's such a visual guy. You know, you mentioned with Aang that his priorities, he seems to have put away the script as being a priority for taking on projects. And I think Michael Bay's been like that for a long time, you know, because he falls in love with the visual aesthetic more than the people, the characters. I mean, a lot of it, and women, like in a Michael Bay movie, a woman is like a sports car. Like, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
It's all about the way she's lit and where she's parked. And like, you know, there's really no, you know, you can ask a car a question, but no one waits to hear it answer, you know?
Well, Mandy Moore is listed about fifth on the new Midway film, the World War II movie, directed by Roland Emmerich. I wonder how she'll feel about that. Those are also movies that feel like they're big, huge spectacles that the talent sometimes gets lost in. But so that sort of makes sense with you, like you, because you understand the world that they're drawing from. You have respect for the comic books and the stories that they're telling. But you're not there as a patsy to just say, oh, you're doing great. You actually care enough to want them to be as good as they possibly can.
Yeah, and so a lot of times I'll go to screenings and I rarely make it to my car before the studio's calling to see what I thought, because I never really write reviews, so I never tell the public what I think. The only way the public knows what I think is because of the emphasis of choice. Like when I was doing Hero Complex for the LA Times, I got to pretty much pick what I wrote about all the time. And I just wouldn't write about things if I didn't like them. So
exactly,
you know, like with Super 8, for instance, you know, I wrote probably 12 stories about that movie before opening day, you know, and ended up doing live events on stage with the cast and filmmakers and stuff, and talking to Spielberg and Kathy Kennedy and everybody, because I was intrigued by it. But if you go back, the movie Battleship came and went, and you would not, there's no fossil record of it. You know, my body of work. So like, as far as I'm concerned, it didn't happen.
That's what I've done with my freelance career. I've only written about things I've been excited by, and that's why I have the career I enjoy today.
That's right. People feel the energy difference too, you know?
Yeah, they do. Moving on to Joker. Are you excited by Joker? I don't know what's more exciting to you, the record-breaking box office of the movie or the fact that it's a serious Oscar contender?
You know, I don't think it is a serious Oscar contender at this point, just because of all the controversy. I think that knowing the Academy and the Academy voters the way I do, or think I do at least, that's the last thing they want, is to support something that they're going to now have. To them, it's suddenly associated with things like school shootings. You know, it's like,
it's nihilistic.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like after Columbine you know, people got edgy about the Matrix and what it represented and things like that. And a lot of it, it's kind of part of it. It's just evidence, I think, sometimes of the drumbeat of media coverage, you know, like, and I'm obviously part of that. But, you know, before that movie came out, before Joker came out, you saw there was 2 weeks of hand-wringing about what will people do? Will there be violence? Should the police go to theaters and stuff? And I just didn't really understand. I said, you know, how does a movie that no one has seen incite people to violence before they've seen it?
Well, the same way that, you know, someone like Bob Dole, when he was running for president in 1996, said that Trainspotting was glorifying heroin use and drug use when it was doing anything but that. they don't watch the movie and they just kind of...
Well, somebody called in a threat as well on Joker, I believe. They had a credible threat. So I think that's... But this was 2 weeks before that happened. And people were already saying, oh, it's going to engender violence. And I agree with you. It seems a bit much. Maybe Joaquin Phoenix could be a contender and best actor? Or is, again, is it too of a dark of a performance?
I think he could. And I think that that's where its chances best lie. The thing that I'm most excited about with Joker is what it represents. I'm skeptical if this is actually going to be the case, but it would seem to represent a movie that is not built for sequel,
right?
And it's based on a comic book, and so and it's funny is that I was thinking about this the other day is that DC films often get, you know, they're denigrated compared to the success that Marvel's had. Marvel Studios specifically, and even DC is considered, I think, lagging behind Fox, you know, and their X-Men movies and such. But the thing that DC has done well is if you look at the movies that they've done, they're based on DC comics that aren't necessarily thought of as DC movies, but they are, like Road to Perdition and V for Vendetta and Constantine. And if you start counting those films as DC movies and start thinking about the legacy of movies that don't have sequels and that aren't made for sequels and are about directors, and then there could be a push towards something that's actually a better comic book movie down the line. Like I wouldn't mind if, you know, the next three Batman movies, if, because we all know there's going to be three more and three after that, whatever.
Batman Arkham Asylum.
Yeah. No, I mean, why not announce a three-film series where there's three different directors doing three different Batman stories with three different lead actors and set in different time periods or like whatever. Like, you know, like the graphic novel and comics, no one picks up Dark Knight Returns, the Frank Miller one from the 80s, and says, hey, this doesn't fit with canon. You know, like they don't complain about it. They just view it as it's like an opera. It's a standalone kind of collage art or representation of these sort of archetypes and they take it on its own value. And I think that could lead to better movies.
Well, there are a lot of possibilities in even just a franchise like Batman, and not just multiple characters, but like you say, multiple time periods, multiple approaches to the story, even, God forbid, or God willing, a goofy one like the 60s TV series. But I feel like this Joker is a big win for Warner Brothers and the DC Universe, not because it's going to launch a franchise, not because Joaquin is going to face off against Batman, but because filmmakers will say, you know what, I can go there, just like DC has taken gambles with people and let them do their own thing on Guardians of the Galaxy or Thor, Ragnarok, and let them fly and see what happens. And so maybe Warner Brothers will get a reputation of, hey, we'll let you gamble and roll the dice and do something different, and we'll support you.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that and also the other interesting thing is with DC is the advent of their rated R movies. You know, I mean, Harley, Birds of Prey is going to be rated R. Joker's rated R. I'm assuming Suicide Squad sequel is going to be rated R. And you're not going to see Marvel be able to do that because of the Disney ownership. You know, they're not going to let their mainstream characters be in rated R films, especially if they can't use them on Disney Plus, and Disney Plus is not going to have any rated R content on it. So it'll be interesting to see how Disney handles that in general. Like, you know, are they going to let Fox be the place where that they do that, where they do that with films like Deadpool and Venom, or take advantage of Hulu, which I saw has a new Marvel show, which is kind of strange, out of left field. Some of the scarier stuff, maybe like Ghost Rider or something like that. I don't know.
Well, you know, you do cover a lot more than pop culture and comic book movies. You used to cover music a lot for LA Times, that you don't have that outlet at Deadline, obviously. But you do cover classic films, not just the popcorn movies. The Shawshank Redemption, it's the 25th anniversary of that movie. And you've got a piece also coming out today, I think, or later this week, talking about that film. Well, why does that film matter to you? It's like the film that dads everywhere love. Godfather and then Shawshank Redemption. You can guarantee if you ask a guy his favorite movie over a certain age, they will say The Shawshank Redemption.
Well, or they go, you know, like they try to be really subversive and say Godfather 2.
Right.
No.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, that movie, both those films are right up there as far as film fans, male film fans, especially male film fans of a certain age. I think, you know, what's interesting is with this one is how, and I called up Frank Darabont and talked to him about it, about the theatrical release. I mean, this is a film, you know, most movies are released. This one escaped. It did so badly. I really feel for it. I think that initial theatrical run, that it was, you know, the title threw people off. You know, I don't think that they understood what the title meant or what it was. I think the length of the film, maybe the bleakness of it, and it sure didn't help that it opened the same Friday as Pulp Fiction.
It made like $60 million, but it cost $25 million to make.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a complete flop disaster, but it certainly did not indicate the massive afterlife it would have on cable and DVD, which has been truly remarkable.
Exactly. I remember seeing this movie in the movie theater.
You do or don't?
I do.
You know, well, you probably saw it after it got its Oscar nominations. It was nominated for Best Picture, and that's when they re-released it. And so it got a second bite at the apple, thanks to the trophy contest. But it was on USA and TNT, I think, that this movie put in the time.
Yeah.
You know, and became, you know, something more than a movie. It's sort of like It's a Wonderful Life, but with prison rapes.
It made about half its money after the Oscar nominations came out. So it made, in the North America, it made about $15 million before, and it made another $15 million afterwards. So it definitely doubled its box office. That's one of the best results you can get for a decent-sized movie from an Oscar nomination.
Exactly. You know, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a movie that benefited more, but also that's because it needed it so bad. You know, I was saying...
It had nowhere to go but up.
Yeah, exactly. On the opening night, it was just like the guy in the movie. I mean, there was no witnesses. There was nobody there.
So when you look back on that film, perhaps you watched it again, you spoke to people about it. What do you now realize most about this movie? And I think the answer is you love prison films.
I really do, Michael. You know, and you and I have known each other for a long time. I mean, probably since 85, 86, something like that.
Yeah.
Good long time.
You know, when you were both in preschool, of course.
Yeah. Michael was teaching it. No. but I do have this kind of a real affection or affinity for movies about prisons. And I mentioned this to you not too long ago and as a joke, but also it's kind of true. Like, I mean, Cool Hand Luke and Papillon, I adore those movies. I love Escape from Alcatraz and Brubaker and
The Great Escape.
The Great Escape is probably my favorite. It's the movie I've seen more than any other movie. I think I've watched that movie. That and The Last Waltz are probably the two movies I've watched the most in my life.
Well, but you know, when you think about it, it makes sense because stories in general, whether in a book or on stage or in a movie, are designed in part to take you into another world. Sometimes, you know, with Star Wars, that's literal. In the case of a movie, it's taking you into somebody else's world, and stories are also filled with conflict. Here, you've got both, you know, are heightened in a prison setting because you're in a world that most people don't have a real, a majority of people don't have any experience with and are somewhat afraid of. And there's a lot of conflict.
Yeah, I think those things all absolutely apply. And I think there's also the just the really available anti-authority themes. I mean, you can't really get much more authoritarian than being a warden or a, you know, you think of the people that play wardens in movies or the performances like Cool Hand Luke or that movie, The Castle or... what was the football movie with Burt Reynolds that was so great?
The Longest Yard.
Yeah, The Longest Yard with Eddie Albert, I think, was as the warden. So it makes itself available for that. There's also kind of gadgets and tunnels and I don't know, that sneaky stuff like Great Escape and Stalag 17. I think as a kid, that stuff really appealed to me. And the injustice of it, which is, you know, gets back to the Shawshank appeal, is I think that it goes to the basic cathartic possibilities of entertainment that, you know, we watch somebody, like in a movie like Shawshank or a musical like Les Mis, and watch this person be beset by injustice and unfairness and inequity and, you know, travesty and all these things, for a really long period of time. And then, you know, they escape or they redeem themselves or they, you know, do the Count of Monte Cristo and get everybody back or whatever it is. But I think that prison sort of makes that stuff available. I don't know.
Absolutely. We feel beleaguered in our real lives, but we can't quite put our finger on it. But then you can see that movie and say, yes, that is injustice. And you can see them fight back and succeed. So it's kind of satisfying.
Attica.
Exactly. Well, Jeff, you know, you, however, do not have to fight against injustice because you are already successful. So we'll send people to your stuff at Deadline and the silo that you oversee. Do you like being the Nick Fury of that silo? Does that make sense?
Well, you know, I don't know how that affects my film, the film speed, if it's a certain amount per hour. You know, when you said the Nick Fury thing, I'm like, okay, so what is that? How does that affect my frame rate? I don't know.
The hero. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I was portrayed by an alien in the entire last appearance.
Right. You know, so you're at the Hero Nation silo, and we've got links to your story with Ang Lee and the stuff to look forward to from Shawshank and Venom. They can find that on your website. And we appreciate you taking the time to stop by.
It's great talking to you guys.
Well, that was great of Jeff to stop by. You know, he's really a big deal at head Deadline there, you know, doing the silo and the pop culture. I wish he covered music there like he did at the LA Times. But, you know, it's great of him to take the time to stop by and talk to us about Ang Lee and Joker and all the stuff going on.
Well, a couple things. Mm-hmm. He has been a big deal at just about every place he's worked, from the Los Angeles Times for 20 odd years to, I think he was at Entertainment Weekly for a while. And, he knows his stuff when it comes to pop culture and comic books and that kind of, basically genre stuff.
Basically all of Hollywood, the stuff that Hollywood does most of the time. Hey, wait a second.
What?
You said big deal. You said the words big and deal. That must mean it's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Sperling, what is our first story?
You know, today is backwards day, actually. And I was just repeating what you said. You said big deal.
I said big deal.
Yes, you did. But, you know, Jeff Boucher is a big deal, which is why we said that. Now, how is this for balance? 1 year ago, the Nobel Prize for Literature was rocked by a Me Too scandal of sexual harassment and the like. Although rocked, isn't that more of a musical term?
Keep going.
In any case, no award was handed out at all last year. It all happened in the context of people in the world of arts grappling with what to do when you respect an artist's work, but not perhaps the artist themselves. So this year, they handed out a winner for 2018 and another for 2019. Olga Tokarczuk is a dreadlocked feminist and Polish activist who hits the bestseller list in her home country with novels like Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead, which became the film Spore. She gained worldwide visibility when her sixth novel, Flights, won the International Booker. The committee honored her work, which focuses on migration and cultural transitions, a choice that resonates with a timely focus. You bet. That's correct. But just to show you that they're not that woke, the 2019 Nobel Prize for Literature has gone to Austrian Peter Handke, a playwright and novelist who said the Nobel Prize for Literature should just stop already, saying their choices were poor.
Now everyone agrees.
More famously, Handke loudly and repeatedly has praised the Serbian war criminal Slobodan Milosevic. The writer attended his trial at The Hague and even spoke glowingly at Milosevic's funeral. He also accused Muslims of staging their own massacre in Sarajevo and then, you know, went on blaming it on Serbia. In a rare action, PEN America criticized Nobel for its choice. In contrast, by the way, Tokarczuk's publisher in Poland had to hire bodyguards to protect her from constant threats made by those on the far right. Of course, Hanka also wrote the play Walk About the Villages, the novel Repetition, and the screenplay for the masterpiece Wings of Desire with director Wim Wenders, so there's that. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's the Nobel Prize for Literature. It's fun to argue and debate about every year when it comes out. They promise to be less male and less Eurocentric. Well, almost. Both winners were from Europe, but at least one was a woman. The people who are complaining about Peter Handke winning the Nobel Prize, I understand the desire not to rush to honor someone who's got that ugly personal life. Absolutely true. You don't need to honor him. You know, his work still stands there. But I'd be more interested if they were saying the work wasn't Nobel worthy. Nobody seems to be making that argument. So apparently, even though knowing what the stances he has taken publicly may make you rethink some of his work, that hasn't happened yet. And people aren't saying, you know what, this stuff doesn't hold up, or it's not good, or it was overpraised in the first place. They're not making that argument. So I'm not happy that they ran out to praise him. It wasn't necessary. But I am still interested in seeing his work, because nobody is saying the stuff is not Nobel quality.
You don't hear a lot about the TV drama Project Blue Book. In fact, I hear nothing about it until I just said the words Project Blue Book. The sort of X-Files drama airs on the History Channel and was Basic Cable's biggest hit in live plus seven numbers, averaging 3.3 million viewers per episode. That made History, the History Channel, the number one basic cable channel on Tuesday nights. Those aren't Game of Thrones numbers. But number one really is still number one. Season two will begin in January, continuing the show's dive into the actual files of the Air Force's secret investigation into UFOs. And here's some good news. The drama added 10 new territories worldwide, including Germany, and brought its footprint up to 165 territories worldwide. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, this is bringing us back to what we've talked about a lot over the past few years. TV makes so much money with worldwide sales, and they never talk about it. And this show is playing in 165 territories. They're not giving it away for free. Obviously, some of these really small countries aren't paying a lot of money per episode, but that money sure adds up. It'd be great to hear exactly what the numbers are, how much money it's making. You know, you look at shows like The Blacklist on NBC, down to Project Blue Book on the History Channel. These shows make a ton worldwide, and they never discuss it. 165 territories. I'd love to open up that accounting.
And they will never allow that.
We'd have to sue. They have to hide the profits from the creatives, and then they have to sue in court and then settle before we get to actually see the numbers.
Last week, we mourned the death of drummer Ginger Baker. His biggest mark came with two short-lived supergroups, Cream and Blind Faith. A supergroup is when already famous artists get together to form a new band. Think the Traveling Wilburys, which featured Tom Petty, Roy Orbison, George Harrison, Jeff Lynne, and Bob Dylan.
And Bob Dylan, good heavens. Don't say those names so blithely. Roy Orbison, Tom Petty, a Beatle, and Bob Dylan, good Lord.
And Jeff Lynne.
Yeah, OVLO, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, the K-pop world has created one of the first boy band groups. They brought together some of the biggest names from K-pop bands and put them all together into Super M. And it worked. Their debut EP is a big hit in Korea, and it has topped the Billboard charts in the U.S. Did I emphasize that properly?
Yeah.
Big deal or big whoop?
It's probably a big whoop. I don't think there are enough boy bands around in the U.S. to create a super group. And if you did, it would be artists who'd been around for so many years, like Backstreet Boys mixing with NSYNC, that it wouldn't have the same impact. Because these are hot young artists from hot young boy band groups in the world of K-pop who are coming together really early in their careers to create Super M. So I don't think it's really replicable, but it's fun and interesting to see.
Fox News, and you should now be laughing, just lost the news part of its name. Anchor Shepard Smith, who led the channel's actual hour of news, as opposed to the entertainment and opinion shows featuring talking heads like Sean Hannity, has abruptly quit his job. Smith was hardly a liberal, but he and Chris Wallace have been the last remaining link to hard news and a modest emphasis on facts. After internal struggles against Hannity and the like, Smith has said enough is enough, and he is moving on. where the openly gay actor,
anchor.
Yeah, he's an anchor.
he was acting when he was in the closet.
Yeah, well, where he might go next is hard to say, but it's certainly a loss for Fox News and the staffers who respected his work. Big deal or big whoop?
It's probably a big whoop for Fox News. I mean, having him there and being able to point to him was helpful and useful to a degree, but it wasn't a big part of the bottom line. His show was on in the afternoon. I'm sure it made them money, but it was not a big generator of cash. However, I worked for the New York Post for a while as a freelancer. I mean, I contributed to them for many years, but as a freelancer, and still just that vague connection to Fox News, I was glad to be able to say, well, they're Shep Smith. And there are a lot of people who work there who could take some sanity and some defense and some self-worth out of saying, well, you know, at least we do have that news hour that's actually sort of respectable. It was not like watching PBS NewsHour, but it was, in fact, saner compared to the rest of Fox News and made you sort of feel like you had some purpose there, and that's gone. So I think that just hurts morale a lot. But don't get too excited about Shep Smith as a talent. I mean, I've interviewed him. Good guy, doing good work there. Coming out, that was really important and great to do. But just like Megyn Kelly, he's not poisonous like Megyn Kelly. But don't think, oh man, people are going to love to have Shep Smith. You know, he's still a conservative talk show host, you know, newscaster. So he'll have a role to play somewhere. But don't go overboard like you did with Megyn Kelly. She has a lot more negatives to her than he did because she was one of those talking heads who trafficked in extremist positions. Shep Smith does not, and he is rooted in hard news, but I'm not sure how much of a draw he will be elsewhere.
Last week tonight, they had a whole bunch of, like, I don't want to say outtakes, but like little funny things that Shepard Smith did.
Oh, yeah.
And he was, he kind of poked fun at himself. He was very funny.
Yeah. And, let me put it this way. He could be freed by this, not being at Fox News. Maybe he's got a lot of stuff he could do and will do that. Not that he's going to change his political stripes, but he may be more of a force than you think about.
Every time there's a new format in entertainment, the big multinational corporations come hat in hand and beg for a little help, usually from, you know, guilds. We're trying to launch compact discs, they say, and we can't possibly afford the standard royalty rates. With DVD, they said, we can't possibly afford any royalty rates. Artists invariably give in, God knows why, and those new lower rates punish them for years to come. That's what is happening with streaming. Lots of people are getting lower rates and often lower residuals, or, you know, no residuals at all. And it's killing the musicians who perform scores for countless TV shows. Now they're speaking out, calling the crisis an extinction-level event. You know, there are a few dinosaurs that might disagree with that, by the way. With more and more shows being made for streamers, that means musicians are getting lower pay and no residuals. Those modest payments every time a show airs have long been the lifeblood for workaday actors and writers and directors and musicians. No more, and it's making it impossible for them to sustain a career. Talks continue between the American Federation of Musicians and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. The big sticking point? The terms in a 2014 deal that gave residuals to above-the-line talent but denied them to below-the-line folks like musicians. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. To me, it's worth going on strike for. You cannot let this go. You know, you already took lower pay plus no residuals, and you've been doing it for 5 years. Enough is enough. The money is pouring into streaming. They're making big bucks. You should be getting back to where you were at least 5 years ago. And if you can't strike over that, why not?
How do you measure it? I'm not arguing against you. I'm saying,
well, they're getting lower pay and no residuals. For the love of God, they like the actors who get more pay because there's no back end. They should be getting more pay at the very least. They can't create a residual thing unless they get into some argument. And they don't want to share the numbers of what shows do, but unless they want to get into a debate about, okay, it's streamed this many times, therefore we should get this. I mean, that would be like a residual. Or they could say, yes, Fine, pay us a lot more than, you know, what we were getting before, not less.
Correct.
So if this isn't worth striking over, I don't know what isn't. However, extinction level event, clever, cute. Let's save it for the end of the world, however. Let's not cheapen that anymore. You know, let's not just start saying, you know, Fortnite going down for 4 days is an extinction level event. Because it actually is a threat to humanity. But anyway.
No, but I woke up on Friday and there was no internet and hardly any cell phone service because there was a wildfire raging in
Were you
Los
out
Angeles.
Of power completely?
I was not out of power. The power had gone out overnight and then came back on by the morning. But, you know, it was pretty eerie. You know, you look outside and it's basically filled with smoke. And you can smell that, you know, it smells like you're in a forest fire. And, you know, there's no cell service. And you're like, wow.
The zombie apocalypse is here.
Exactly.
Wow, that's scary. And it's and you can look forward to that happening all the time, thanks to your public-private utility, PG&E.
Actually, they're in the north.
They didn't affect
Southern
you?
California. Yeah, we have SoCal Edison, the PG&E of the south.
Oh, did they do did they choose to shut down overnight?
I think that they warned that they would be.
Wow.
Because the winds were pretty severe. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they're afraid that, you know, a live wire landing on the ground.
Well, they're afraid that they have not spent their profits to properly prepare for the future. And therefore, they will get sued for the negligence that they have, you know, lived it up on instead of putting their money into putting lines into the ground, doing proper clearance, doing proper safety checks, getting new equipment and doing all the money they should have spent on the billions in profits. They were doing it to their shareholders and their CEOs. And now the piper is being paid.
Yeah,
it's not about them. Oh God, they're in a rock and a hard place. It's them neglecting the infrastructure because they wanted profits.
Correct. Because
they are they are making money off a public utility, which should really be focused on the safety and fundamental need to get electricity to everyone. It's not something that should be privatized in any way. Doesn't mean it's going to work perfectly, but at least all the money going into it can be used to maintain it and protect it for the future instead of siphoning it off.
You want a real scandal, and you want to see how energy really works in the United States, look up San Onofre, which is a nuclear power plant, a now defunct nuclear power plant, which is not supposed to be defunct. And you will find out how when big leaders who run Southern California Edison make big mistakes, they want their ratepayers to pay that bill.
Of course.
And keep their jobs. So yeah, look that up on
Google.
And
their bonuses.
And it's an eye-opener. But in any case, speaking of eye-openers and speaking of streamers, Netflix might want to work on its relationship? Yeah, its relationship skills. They gave all sorts of love to director Alfonso Cuarón and his passion project, Roma, a film literally no one else was willing to make. And then when it was made, they spent $50 million promoting it to Academy voters. Now Cuarón has signed a new first-look deal for his streaming services with Apple. At the same time, Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg enjoyed a long-term partnership with HBO. The two titans gave HBO prestige content via Band of Brothers and The Pacific, two miniseries focused on World War II. On his own, Hanks also gave HBO the terrific space miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. That's what I say. If my kids don't clean their room, I'm going to bounce them from the Earth to the Moon. Anyway, so when Hanks and Spielberg were ready to make Masters of the Air, a miniseries focused on World War II, as seen from the pilot's point of view, which is, you know, high, up in the air, naturally, they took it to, you know, not HBO, they took it to Apple. Yeah. Is Apple the best new home for artists, or just the new kid on the block with the biggest paychecks? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's wealthy, world-famous artists signing deals with Apple because Apple's the new kid on the block and they have a really big paycheck. You know, they're ready to open up their pocketbook. However, it was interesting about HBO. They had walked away from this project focusing on the air services a while ago. The price tag for Masters of the Air was $250 million for 9 episodes. However, Band of Brothers and The Pacific, they were big money earners for HBO, but only or mainly or primarily due to DVD sales and Blu-ray sales. HBO made a mint on selling DVDs and Blu-rays of those miniseries. Men loved them, they bought them, and they watched them again and again. I know people who did that, but now DVD and Blu-ray is kind of gone. And, you know, though it still sits around for big projects like that, but most of that's happening on streaming and on demand. So the people who might have bought it on DVD, they'll just watch it on HBO Go or whatever. So the numbers just did not add up for them. But Apple said, hey, sure, we'll lose money on that.
Well, I mean, I think I wonder if it's not, you know, for HBO, I get it. There's no immediate payoff and it's going to be very hard to justify.
Well, yes, they said they could. They said that the only thing that justified those earlier two was the fact that they made a ton on DVD sales. I mean, I remember Band of Brothers. That was successful, but it really became big on DVD.
You know, I mean, it was certainly.
But now what if I wanted to go watch Band of Brothers, right? And I would have to sign up for HBO Go. And yeah, I didn't
that's what
buy
they want. Yeah, and you're saying.
Yeah, I didn't buy a DVD for, you know, what is it, like $30, $40?
Well, it was more like $80, $90, $120, but yeah.
Well, okay, but yeah, but instead I wound up subscribing to HBO Go or HBO Max or whatever it's going to be called for a year and a half. And, you know, at $15 a month, that's actually some good money.
So you're saying, hey, you know, unlike Netflix, which you think one film, The Irishman, is not a lot, but a 9-part miniseries of a property that's sort of known to draw people to your station, that might be worth shelling out $250 million to sign up an extra million.
$250 is a lot. I mean,
well, no, I'm sure the others were pretty pricey too. I mean, it's an elaborate period war movie. 9 hours, yeah. You know, I'm not surprised that it cost $200. Plus, it's in the air. You know, you can't walk around in the mud. You got to be in a plane. So that's a lot of special effects. So yeah, it's a lot of money. But like you say, that draws a lot of people to your service. You know, I'd rather spend $250 million on that than The Irishman. If I was choosing, I would rather spend it on that. I still don't think Netflix makes a lot of sense with The Irishman.
Well, I guess we're about to find out.
Yeah, but that's a little inside baseball, isn't it? All these details about doing a project as a loss leader so you can sign up subscribers long term.
Yeah, and you know what? Since we're talking about inside baseball, okay, we're about to move into that segment where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, and we explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect our listeners. You know, that segment, inside baseball.
I'm there. I'm with you.
I actually realized I kind of had an inside baseball joke on Friday during the fire. You know, they didn't cancel school, but it was pretty smoky and they had to keep everybody indoors. And I went to pick up my oldest daughter at the high school and everybody came out wearing masks. And I rolled down my window and yelled outside, "Stay strong, Hong Kong." And an hour later, China called and said they can no longer teach Mandarin at the school.
So, Sperling, I actually watched the first 3 episodes of the new seasons of South Park. Have you seen them?
I would say no. No, I have not.
Oh, they're actually very funny. And let's be specific. South Park is taking on the Chinese government, not the Chinese people. So you don't want to say they're taking on China because that implies they've got a beef with, you know, a nation of 1 billion people. No, it's the government we're talking about, the totalitarian, brutal government. Anyway.
Now, did this start, though? I mean, did this whole thing start from the tweet that the general manager of the Houston Rockets...
No, the South Park episode is completely separate. It has nothing to do with that.
Okay, I didn't know...
There's multiple issues here. None of them have to do with each other. It's not like, you know. No, South Park aired their season premiere, and it involves one of the families of South Park moving to the country and starting a marijuana plant farm. And then the dad starts to do business with China, and it goes on from there. And they're sort of mocking the Chinese government and the tactics that they use and the brutal human rights abuses that they have. And the episode is hilarious and, you know, satirical and scathing. And the government freaked out, and they basically scrubbed every reference to South Park behind the Great Firewall. You know, they have their own internet. They have blocked off the world's internet and their own people. They don't know about Tiananmen Square. Apparently, they're not going to be able to find out that South Park exists. You know, they have a very blinkered reflection of reality in China because the government controls the spread of information in that country. So they erased every reference to South Park in the country. So in retaliation, the creators put out a statement. And they said, like the NBA, we welcome the Chinese censors into our homes and into our hearts. We, too, love money more than freedom and democracy. End quote. And then in their next episode that they could, which is the 3rd episode of the season, they mocked them even more.
It just goes to show you how they make that show. Yes. And I'm talking about South Park, is literally they are finishing the show the week it airs.
Well,
they're not the only one. You know, South Park is not the only group of folks that over the past week
butting heads with the Chinese government.
Yeah, basically between the NBA and you have a story here about Blizzard. I guess is a video game company. They're a video game publisher and developer.
Yeah, they oversee World of Warcraft, one of the biggest gaming franchises out there. So Blizzard is a huge company. They did not actually have direct, you know, conflict with the Chinese government as such. What happened was is that a player originally from Hong Kong competed in a tournament that a lot of people were watching online. His nickname is Blitz Chung. And when the round was over, he took off his mask and was being interviewed. And he made a political statement. He said, "Liberate Hong Kong, revolution of our age," which is one of the slogans that the protesters in Hong Kong are saying. That freaked Blizzard out because they know they have big market in China. And in response, they took back the winnings he made from the Grandmaster Tournament. They banned him from the platform for a year. And they say he violated their terms of agreement by engaging in an act that, quote, brings into public disrepute, offends a portion or group of the public, or otherwise damage Blizzard image, end quote. And yes, it was that grammatically incorrect. But that's what they said. In other words, speaking up in favor of freedom and democracy and denouncing a brutal totalitarian regime is offensive.
Now, well, maybe the only thing I have ever agreed with Senator Marco Rubio on is the whole thing about the NBA, where he said, you know, it's one thing to, you know, ban free speech in your country. It's your country, you know, you kind of have a right. But you're actually banning it in and affecting it in our country, in the U.S. at this point.
Right. Well, at least they're trying to. All they have is their, you know, megaphone. In response to a lot of blowback from senators and people in the U.S., the company reduced his suspension to 6 months and admitted they had no real reason to withhold his winnings, so they gave him those. Let's point out the Chinese tech company Tencent. We've mentioned them a lot here on the program. They own 4.9% of Blizzard. And in fact, they own 40% of Epic Games. That's the company behind Fortnite, another huge property. And Epic Games went out in front and said, you know what? No player is going to be banned from our platform for making any political statements whatsoever. So fans immediately started the trending hashtag boycott Blizzard, as you won't be surprised. But I love this move that one people did. They are taking a character that's an Overwatch, a Chinese character, clearly put in the game to appeal to the Chinese market. And they're using that character in tons of imagery that they're peppering on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook to champion the resistance in Hong Kong. And they're making him a symbol of the people in Hong Kong who are protesting, hoping perhaps that they will get Overwatch banned in China because of their subversion of this character. I thought that was pretty clever.
Yeah, look.
That's really playing dirty. The company's like, no, don't use one of our characters in our video game to promote the protesters in Hong Kong. Then they'll just ban our whole game from China. Nobody will be able to play it. But like you mentioned, the NBA is also in hot water. Again, a general manager at an NBA team, the Houston Rockets, tweeted support for the protesters in Hong Kong. Again, he said in quotes, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." Well, all hell broke loose. The NBA said, hey, enough of that. And that freaked everybody else out. They're like, what do you mean he can't say that? It turns out China is the number one overseas priority for the NBA. It is already a huge market for basketball. It is the biggest international market for basketball. A ton of people watch basketball. More than 600 million Chinese watched at least some NBA content in the most recent season for which we have numbers. They did.
Now think about that for just a second. Let's put that in perspective. You said how many million?
600 million people.
I just wanted you to repeat 600 million.
Yes. Well, they
to
also
give you some sense, mm-hmm. In the United States where the NBA is based, there are 300 million people.
Yeah. And now the NBA values a 5-year deal it made with Tencent for digital streaming rights to the NBA. They value that 5-year deal at $1.5 billion. That's real money. So people in the U.S. freaked out when the NBA sort of tamped him down a little bit tentatively. And then they said, oh, no, we're not. He's allowed to say what he says, but we feel weird about this. Now, China TV has refused to air the first two preseason games. They cited specifically the fact that NBA publicly supported the free speech rights of the general manager. Even though they distanced themselves from the comments, they said he doesn't speak for the NBA. They're like, you should not let him speak. Multiple Chinese companies have suspended partnerships with the league entirely. They haven't canceled them, but they have suspended them. That's important to remember. Those include Luckin, a coffee chain, Anta Sportswear, Tencent, a smartphone maker called Vivo, and the broadcaster CCTV. Yao
well,
Ming.
So yeah, I mean, the broadcaster CCTV had no choice because, you know, they're basically
well, none
state
of them
owned.
Do. They're all government controlled, ultimately. Yeah. You know, if the government wants to tell them to do it, they have to. What I love is the people who say, oh, look, the NBA stood firm on freedom of speech after first kowtowing. Right. They have no choice. They can't stop him from free speech. So this is a big mess.
And the weird thing is, like, if you did this at any other job and you ruined a big billion-dollar business deal for your boss or your
employer.
Well,
no deal's been ruined yet. They're just angry.
Right, but you'd be pretty much in hot water. You might lose your job, but now they can't fire him.
You can't lose your job because you have a bumper sticker supporting a party they don't like or saying something they don't want. Delivering free political statement in your own private context. Did he do it on a company Twitter account? I don't know, but I believe he did on his own personal account. You know, actually don't get to fire people because they make a political statement. That's actually what we're talking about here.
Well, you know, what this really did, all of these instances, is it really underscored that it's not the first time this has happened, and these aren't the first companies it's happened to.
Yeah, Apple's been in hot water. They had an app that they took down because China told them to. Then they put it back up because everybody got angry. And now they've just taken it down again that the protesters are using in Hong Kong. So they don't even allow the New York Times app in China. In their phones in China, they don't include the New York Times app because that isn't allowed. So it's a big problem.
Yeah. And, you know, Leica, for instance, I mean, this is long before all of these incidents. Leica, the camera manufacturer that, you know, makes digital cameras and, you know, film cameras. They had a promotional video produced for, you know, not only use in China, but elsewhere. And it had, like, you know, great photography, moments of great photography and award-winning photography.
The tank?
And then, you know, there was a shot of Tank Man.
Whoops.
And of course, China went ballistic and they had to, you know, apologize. The Leica had to apologize. And, you know, so all of these companies find themselves in hot water, and there was at least one story in every major media outlet last week about the number of companies and all of the incidents where these companies have had to kind of backtrack, whether it was Delta or Airlines, or whether it was Leica, the camera manufacturer, the NBA. You know, they basically went through a litany of these issues and how difficult it can be to do business in China, and how it can sometimes be like walking through a minefield.
Right, but it doesn't have to be difficult. You say, yeah, I know we can't control how China treats its own people, and maybe we need to make a serious thought before we do business with a totalitarian state that is abusing human rights and committing perhaps war crimes even as we speak against parts of their population. But the one thing we do know is they don't get to tell us how to live in our country. You know, if they assume you can't tell them what to do, what in God's name would make you think they could tell your employees or your private citizens of your country or a player on a video game who's not even an employee of yours, and he doesn't have free speech when being interviewed about a game he just played? He's not allowed to say what he wants? That's outrageous. So it creates a lot of problems for U.S. companies and international companies, but it also creates a lot of problems for China, because the idea of soft power is not that you get to bully other countries into treating you politely, is that you create content that's so compelling and good that people want what you have. They see American movies, they watch American TV shows and listen to American music, and they think, wow, that's a great country. Well, that's not what China's doing right now. They're creating a bad image for themselves. And while it is a big problem, and I would critique all of these companies and how they've dealt with it one way or another, it's also a big headache for China because they're trying to do business with the world and shut it out at the same time. And that's becoming harder and harder to do every day.
Well, you know, what's really hard is to continue acting if you're not alive.
That's right. Actor Robert Forster died at 78. Among all the things Quentin Tarantino has done, reviving the careers of some very cool people is one of the best things, isn't it?
Yeah, and I actually saw Robert Forster on stage, of all things.
Ooh.
And I can't remember, it was, it was called Chasing Memories. It was, believe it or not, it was back in 2017, it was Robert Forster and Tyne Daly.
Well, she's a terrific actress. She's, what do you mean, believe it or not, she's one of the great stage actors of our time, a Tony-winning, you know, legend.
No, but I mean, you know, here in Los Angeles at the Geffen Playhouse.
Well, sure.
I wouldn't expect that.
Why not?
Cagney
and Lacey, the musical, let's do it. Was it a good show?
Yes, I do remember it being a fairly good show, actually.
Well, there you go. So Tarantino revived the career of John Travolta, who's come back from the dead multiple times, Pam Grier, and especially Robert Forster with Pam Grier on his film...
Jackie Brown.
That's right. It got him an Oscar nomination. That was a great second act for an actor who had never really made it in the first place. It's really his first act, in a way. His film career began pretty nicely with a film directed by John Huston, starring Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor. Unfortunately, it was the massive flop called Reflections in a Golden Eye. He also starred in Haskell Wexler's much admired but little seen film
Medium Cool.
Yeah, that's a great film, but very few people know about it. It was downhill from there. He was doing B-movies. He actually had a chance at two TV series, neither one of them worked, and then it just guest starring roles, and then second guest star, and B-movies like Alligator, a creature flick that he starred in with an unknown Bryan Cranston. He was kind of a never made it rather than a has-been.
Right.
And at one point, he'd gone 2 years without getting a job when Quentin Tarantino came a-calling, and that led to a great Second Life, Mulholland Drive, Breaking Bad, Twin Peaks Revisited. Vince Gilligan even went over the top and called him the Spencer Tracy of his generation. Well,
yeah, the problem is Spencer Tracy worked quite a bit.
And he had a great career. I mean, Foster's a lovely actor, and he's that type of actor for sure. But, you know, there are almost no one is as good a screen actor as Spencer Tracy. But a great, and people in Hollywood love him and love this story because it lets them all feel like, you know what, I never got my break, or I got my break and I've fallen down on hard times, but it could all come back again. They love that story, that Cinderella story. Maybe hold on, because you never know.
And almost good as a prison story.
Exactly.
But you know what? If you liked our story and you liked our show, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And yes, Spotify is coming, I believe, this week. Look, rate and review the shows in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. And that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can also write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter at showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Along with links to all of the stories we talked about today, including links to Jeff Boucher's work. I'd like to thank Jeff Boucher for joining us today. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. Michael, what is it this week?
This week it's iHeartHighFrameRate.com. And strangely, that website is still available. It will be available forever.
Yes, exactly. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage on that still available website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com to read some of his work there, where all of his coverage of the entertainment industry can be found. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.